Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. The November 6th general election is just 3 weeks away, and our local midterm coverage continues today in a conversation with Democratic congressional candidate Alan Ellison. Ellison is vying to represent Florida's 17th congressional district, which covers a large swath of central Florida, stretching from the eastern Tampa Bay area to the western edge of Lake Okeechobee and as far south as northern Lee County. Ellison is a community organizer and policy expert who hails from Highlands County. He faces Republican Greg Stube in November, who we've also reached out to and invited on our show. Ellison was chosen by Democratic Party leaders out of the 9 counties included in the 17th congressional district to take over the race after the recent death of April Freeman, who had won the Democratic primary election in August. I caught up with Ellison last week between stops on the campaign trail. Let's hear that conversation now. I just wanted to start off by taking a look at your background. I understand you're a Florida native, and more precisely, you grew up in a rural, primarily agriculture-based region of the state.
That's exactly right. I grew up in Wachula, Florida.
I also understand that your parents kind of had a background, father as a minister and your mother as a special needs instructor. Can you tell me a bit about maybe how they impacted your views on the importance of public service, like the position you're seeking?
Well, I'll tell you, being that my father is a minister, one of the things that he taught me about being a public servant is to understand, first of all, what I was brought into this world to do, and understanding my gift. And so my gift is the gift of helps. That's what I do. And growing up, everything that I've done pretty much was to help somebody some type of way. In my early life as a professional, I was basically helping individuals to set up businesses and helping them start nonprofits, 501c3s, helping them to put together proposals and business plans and things of that nature. Basically just trying to stimulate the economy and my environment and my cities and my county and the surrounding counties. And so for me, running for office is really a way to maximize my gift, because whenever I'm drafting documents to help an individual, I could really use the same amount of energy and time to be able to write policy that would help hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. So I got that from my father, to be able to maximize my gift. What I got from my mom is being able to understand people where they are and having compassion for people who are less fortunate or might not have the same level of abilities as other people. And so I think that's probably where I get my passion for helping Americans with disabilities, because being around individuals with disabilities growing up, I found out that these people have really big hearts and they need people in leadership looking out for them. So, it was my parents really who gave me that foundation that I'm now getting the chance to exercise a bit. So it's always a beautiful thing when you can marry your gift with your purpose in life. And so I feel running for office is really about a calling more than anything else.
And I do want to come back to, your emphasis on helping those with disabilities in just a little bit, because, you have made that, one of the major issues of your platform. So I do want to get into that a little bit more later. But first, talking about your education, I know you earned a bachelor's degree in political science with a concentration in business administration. What led you toward that particular path of academic interest?
Well, it was Florida Southern College in Lakeland. I was actually in an American government class at a junior college, South Florida Community College, which is South Florida State College now. But I was in American government class, and Dr. Fitzgerald was speaking about servant leadership and the American government and how people can make impact. And at the time, I was a business major, and I ended up becoming so inspired by that particular class that I decided to go ahead and just switch my major over, because the way that he was talking about making an impact, it really resonated with who I am as an individual. So I began to really start to get involved with like community organizing, think tanks and things of that nature. And it just kind of led from one thing to another.
And on that note, you served as treasurer of the Community Economic Council and also as the organization's advocate in Washington. Tell me about that organization and its work, its mission, and your role with that group.
Well, actually, the organization started out as a think tank. I was working as a barber in Bartow, Florida, and every Tuesday night, a group of guys that wanted to make positive change in the community, we would get together and just, you know, brainstorm on different ways that we could do this. And so I decided to go ahead and try to organize their efforts from not just being in the barbershop, but to actually, you know, going and incorporating an entity and getting a 501c3. And so the Community Economic Council was established through that think tank. And basically what we were doing was we were trying to stimulate trade and commerce in the community of Bartow, Florida. And basically we would hold seminars to help stimulate entrepreneurship. We would hold seminars to educate business owners on how to do business with the state, local, and federal government. And we would basically just bring out small business development councils, businesses, bank speakers from around the country to educate, stimulate, and train individuals who are really interested in business. And then on every second Saturday, we would shut down the streets in Bartow and we would just hold festivals, all aimed at stimulating trade and commerce in the area. And so through that, we were able to help many business owners establish their businesses and get contracts and learn the business process. And so that's what the Community Economic Council was all about.
Would it be fair to say that your work with the Community Economic Council kind of put you in a better position to do what you would later do in terms of founding the Center for Economic and Policy Development?
Yeah, it was very instrumental. Actually, the Center for Economic and Policy Development is an extension or a continuation of what we were doing with the Community Economic Council. But what I wanted to do with the center was to duplicate my efforts in one county, but I wanted to take it throughout the entire region of the District of 17 and go into other states. I wanted this program to be duplicated in other states and as well as other countries. So we're actually working with several countries to help stimulate economic development and provide training programs as well as mentorship programs, what I call the Emerging Leaders Initiative. Through the initiative, you know, because growing up in Hardy County, I didn't really have a whole lot of access to individuals who were in the fields of science, politics, medicine, engineering. So we created this platform to be able to help young, bright minds connect with opportunities and potential internships in the fields that they would like to be in. And so those fields would be science, medicine, politics, law, engineering, and basically just leveraging my my network of individuals that I deal with to be able to help them to serve as mentors to these young, bright minds.
Can you tell me about maybe some of the areas, other rural parts of the U.S. or, as you had mentioned, other countries that the center is working with?
One of the countries that we're working with is Ghana. We have a hub over in Accra that we're doing some things with, and we work with other nonprofit organizations that are doing some building some irrigation systems in Nigeria. We're working with organizations that are bringing medical aid relief to Nigeria to try to combat the malaria problems over there. The other thing that we're doing is trying to institute a secondary educational system in Ghana by helping the people on the ground with computers and laptops and printers and just educational material over there. Here in the U.S., we're working with nonprofits in Athens, Ohio. We're working with nonprofits in Washington, D.C., and just basically trying to use those as hubs to spread from there. My goal with that is to be pretty much in every state, all of the rural areas, helping people to revitalize their communities. And if it's anything like what's going on in our community, that's basically finding creative ways to stimulate their economies in the event that they might be losing out on you know, a sector of their economy. Like, for example, and where I'm from, we have the citrus industry. And so the citrus industry is being affected by citrus greening and canker and various types of agricultural barriers that is hurting the citrus industry here. So what the Economic Council is doing is working with various farming entities from around the country to come into the area and start working on like hydroponic farming initiatives to help bring in the economy. We're looking at doing things like reducing fodder as a way to feed the livestock and the animals that traditionally feed on other material that may not be able to be produced as quickly as some of the hydroponic raw materials that we're able to produce. And so just basically trying to fill a void in areas that may need our help. And so it's a relatively new organization, but we're off to a very good start. And I hope to be able to do more once I'm in Congress to stimulate the area, the region, and in the country. So
that's interesting. Really kind of like a narrowly focused form of local economic diversification. I mean, on the one hand, if citrus, at least in the short term, until we find some sort of viable solution for issues like greening, isn't going to be able to pay the bills, you're still helping these folks utilize the skill sets they already have.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're talking to farming companies and entities that can produce at least 8 different food crops in the area. So I've already been around speaking to some of the farm and agricultural leaders of the area. And, you know, it's been pretty positive in terms of the reception. But we have a lot of work to do. And I'm positive that we're going to be able to help subsidize some of the agricultural business that's being lost to the citrus greening.
I mentioned earlier I wanted to come back to the disabilities issue because in some of your campaign literature, you call that issue, quote, the sleeping giant in the room. How so?
Well, whenever you look at all of the other national issues that get a lot of traction, like jobs in the economy, immigration, health care, they all have a number associated with them that negatively affects those demographics. But when you look at the disabilities issue, there's 56 million people in this country that live with a disability. And then whenever you look at that individual that has a disability, that individual has at least one other person that serves in the form of a caretaker role. So now that number of people that are disadvantaged with a disability goes to 100 million or over 100 million people that are either directly or indirectly affected by a disability. That number is larger than the unemployment number. It's larger than the immigration number of people that are living here undocumented. It's larger than people that don't have health insurance. And then the thing about it is that it's a nonpartisan issue. It's an issue where you can be perfectly healthy today, get in a car accident, and be disabled tomorrow and have to depend on someone or some system to help you in your life. And I feel like because it's such a huge issue and so many people have to live with a disability, I feel like there hasn't been very much leadership on the issue. So I want to be that champion for the issue. You know, growing up with my mother being an instructor for people with special needs, I got a chance to see firsthand just how important it is to look after people who have disabilities. And so one of the organizations that I helped to found was Boundless Abilities Foundation. It's a foundation that helps people with disabilities to be able to get access to wheelchairs, to get access to vehicles that can help move them around, help get caretakers. And so, you know, it's a passion, and everything that I do it with passion. I always tell people that, you know, trying to run for Congress is really not about some vain and blind attempt at trying to boost myself. It's really about maximizing my gift. And, you know, this is what I do every day. Whenever the cameras aren't rolling and we're not on the radio, this is what I'm out here doing.
And I wanted to move on to the issue of veterans care, because that's another thing that your platform emphasizes. Certainly a big issue here in Florida, considering we have the third highest veteran population in the country. And of course, you know, for years now, we've regularly been hearing politicians like Governor Rick Scott and others touting efforts to make Florida the most veteran-friendly state in the country. But you've talked about how, you know, in many ways we are failing vets. How would you work in Congress to improve services for our military veterans?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, when you look at our defense system, right now we are spending more money than every country in the world with the military combined. But the majority of our revenue that we're spending in defense, it's not going to veterans and it's not going to active military personnel. It's going to these for-profit companies like Lockheed Martin, Halliburton, Raytheon, you know, Black Hawk, Blackwater, all of these companies that if when you add them up, their CEOs probably total less than 1,000 individuals who are getting the majority of our defense budget. When an individual serves in the military and serves this country, put their lives on the line, sacrifice their time with their family, we should honor that and we should do everything in our power to make sure that when they come home from a life of service, that they are looked after. And that's not what's going on, and it's really disturbing for me. So one of the things that I would do is I would work diligently to try to make sure that the majority of our defense budget isn't going to private companies, that it's going actually to where it's supposed to go, where it was meant to go from the very beginning, and that is to our military men and women and our veterans. You know, they shouldn't have to be worrying about getting a claim through the VA, letting it take up to 200 days before they're even to get a claim through. We have to make sure that we streamline the paperwork. We have to put more manpower into the VA system to make sure that, you know, our veterans are getting the help and the services that they deserve. And so, yeah, of course, that is one of the issues that I champion, because I feel like, you know, I have relatives who are veterans. I have friends who are veterans. My campaign manager was a disabled veteran. And from what I understand, it is tough. It is tough. And we can do better.
You're also emphasizing the importance of Medicare and retirement benefits for seniors. And I'm wondering if this maybe stems from just what you've witnessed from those that you've tried to help through community organizing initiatives over the years. What are you seeing? What are seniors telling you?
Yeah, you know, growing up in Hardy County, being a neighbor to Highlands County, which has one of the largest retiree populations in the country, you get a chance to see this firsthand on a daily basis. Most of our retirees are on fixed incomes. And the thing about trying to plan out life is, you know, if you ever want to make God laugh, just try to plan your life. Because life will always throw you a curveball of something that you were not thinking about or planning for. And so for a lot of our retirees, the thing that they didn't factor into the equation is getting sick and having to pay for medications that can sometimes be on the level of a mortgage payment. And so when those types of things pop up, it throws their whole world off. And so the last thing that they need is for some politicians talking about taking away their Medicaid or Medicare and disability benefits and things that they depend on to get them through the month. And so, you know, I look at it like this. If I'm in Congress, I'll work diligently to make sure that their benefits are protected. But until I get to Congress, I feel like there's things that I could do now. And so one of the things that I've done now is I've set up the Ellison Empowerment Foundation, and it's specifically designed to help seniors to be able to bridge the gap whenever they run into situations where their medical cost is a little too high and they fall back, you know, behind the eight ball on like paying for utility bills or things of that nature. I try to help those individuals through the Ellison Foundation to be able to cover those costs. Now, right now, it's just, you know, my wife and myself, we're flipping the bill on that, but I hope to, you know, have some partners that come in and help with that process, because it is a huge need. And I think whenever seniors should be enjoying the fruits of their labor and relaxing in their older age, a lot of them, that's just not a reality. The last thing, you know, you want to be doing when you're a senior is working at Walmart just to be able to pay for medications and stuff like that. And so I remember back in 2016 when the Republicans were trying to reduce disability payouts by 20%, you know, at the end of the day, this program called entitlements was created because the government was trying to pay for the war efforts. So it's a trade-off. If the government is going to tax its citizens, then the benefit is for there to be entitlement programs. And so whenever you have, you know, people who are trying to take away those benefits, it's clear that they don't understand the concept of serve and protect. You know, we use that term a lot in law enforcement, but the term was actually designed to define the role of government. We serve our country. We serve our public through social programs. We serve them with representatives, and we protect them with our military. We have to have both. There's no either or.
When it comes to those who are still working, you know, your platform has called for an economic recovery, particularly for the middle class and for small business owners. And I was hoping you could tell me a bit more about your position on that issue, particularly within the context of the current administration in Washington and, you know, of course, efforts we've seen to reduce taxes significantly for those whose wealth, I think, would make them far outside of what you could consider the middle class.
Well, I'm a political scientist, and history is my thing. So if we look throughout history, we will always see where the tax system has always benefited the wealthy class, because they, a lot of times, have the resources and the wherewithal and the knowledge, because of their resources, put them in a predicament where they can gain the knowledge to be able to offset their tax payouts through, you know, business and things of that nature. But the middle class and the lower middle class, a lot of times they're not in such a position to learn these strategies and tactics and things of that nature. So we need individuals like myself in positions of influence where we can help to pass legislation that gives them equal opportunities. It's not... I mean, it's very well known that it is the middle class and small businesses that are the driving force of our economy. And we have to do everything in our power to make sure that that classification of individuals, as well as our business owners, have every advantage made available to them so that they can continue to strengthen our economy, because our economy is also the backbone to the global economy. So the stronger our economy is, the stronger the world will be, the better position the U.S. will be in. And so one of the things that I definitely want to be able to do as a representative is to write legislation that streamlines the Small Business Administration. It is small business owners that are the backbone and driving force of our economy. So small business owners should not have to deal with the massive amount of paperwork and all of the intrusive type of questions that come through those applications. I mean, asking questions about your family and this and that, it should be irrelevant to what your vision and goals are for your business. And so I think that if we can reduce the paperwork and reduce the red tape and get the money to those small business owners who have viable business plans and vision, and I think that they will do a lot to help stimulate our economy, create jobs, and put people to work in a big way. I mean, we're getting about $2 billion a year that's being put into the SBA, but the majority of that money is not being utilized for small businesses, just piling up in an account somewhere. And so we want to make sure that we're doing everything in our power to help the middle class with jobs, to create training programs to stimulate entrepreneurship. I want to be able to work with colleges and universities that have business administration programs and to create programs that are geared more towards entrepreneurship, where they get the hands-on type of training that they need to not only go and work for someone in their business, but to have the mindset and the knowledge to actually start their own. And so I think that's going to be the best way that we're going to be able to really grow our middle class and stimulate our economy.
Just changing gears a little bit with the recent appointment of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court, with everything that was leading up to that and, you know, everything we saw playing out in front of the cameras, certainly shed a lot of light on, you know, women's issues and the experience of being a woman in this country in ways that we haven't in the past talked about so openly and publicly. And of course, that's just one aspect of what you're talking about when you place an emphasis on women's rights. There's also, you know, wage inequality, gender bias, gender-based violence, even the criminal justice system. Tell me about why this has become a linchpin of your platform as well.
Well, I'll tell you, standing up for women is something that I've always done. I have a mother, I have 8 sisters, and I have a wife, and I have a daughter. And they pretty much keep me straight. So, It's a moral obligation, hope to be soon a constitutional obligation, because, you know, one of the most powerful forces in this world is a woman. And for them to have so much influence in social settings and not have that much influence in leadership and in politics, I think that it creates a dynamic where they're not always represented in the proper way when you start looking at things like what happened the other day with Kavanaugh. I think if we had more women in positions of influence in the Senate, I don't think that that nomination would have gone down. One of the reasons why I champion women's rights is because, you know, there are a lot of jobs where women are doing equal work and sometimes more work than men, but they're getting paid less than men. On average, it's about 78 cents on the dollar that a man makes for the same work. I think that is wrong. I think that's been going on for far too long, and it's even worse for women of color, and it's even worse for migrant women. And so we want to make sure that women are getting paid what they should be getting paid. We want to make sure that women who are in the criminal justice system is not being raped, not being beat and abused, because, you know, we owe our humanity, and we owe that much to protect one another, you know, as humans. And so we can't allow women to fall through the cracks and get abused. I believe it was 2016 where, in this country, out of all of the human trafficking cases that took place, I think it was about 6,300 women were used for sex trafficking. You know, we have to close those numbers. We have to eradicate that. That's absolutely wrong for people to be trafficked into this country and trafficked out of this country for the purpose of sexual pleasure. You know, there's just so many different issues that I look at, and I realize that we have a responsibility to make it better for women. You know, being an African American and understanding what I understand about the civil rights movement, you know, women got their right to vote when African Americans got their right to vote. So in a lot of regards, the African American movement to equality is right there on par with women's movement to equality. So I'm all about civil rights. I'm all about women's empowerment. And that's another thing that we do with the Ellison Foundation is we try to empower young women who want to go off to college and make something of themselves. We provide scholarships. And so we're trying to do our part now. And I tell people all the time, you know, we got to stop listening to these politicians who talk about what they're going to do when they get in Congress. We have to start looking at individuals based on what they spent a lifetime doing, because a leopard doesn't change its spots. If they've been helping people and before the cameras, before the races, then they're probably going to help people when they get in office. If they've been looking after self and trampling over people, then when they get in office, they're going to continue to do the same thing. And I think we can kind of see that with the president's administration. You know, he hasn't spent a lifetime helping people. He's been a lifetime hurting people, and that's what he's doing now. So.
Well, a final, I guess, hot button issue I'd like to discuss with you is your stance on immigration in this country right now. I understand one of the things that you're calling for, you know, really includes a streamlined process for unauthorized immigrants to achieve some pathway to authorized immigrant status. And I guess, are you concerned about this current pervasive narrative among many politicians in our country right now that seems to be stoking fear of immigrants, characterizing them as dangerous criminals, as opposed to perhaps considering the economic and social benefits they provide?
Yeah, I mean, you have this fear-mongering tactics that come forward from leadership and Congress. But at the end of the day, you know, there are good and bad people in every walk of life, in every culture. The fact of the matter is that immigrants that come here to this country are coming here to bring skills, are coming here to make a better life. And the Department of Labor actually put out a statistic that showed that immigrants are 70% more likely to start businesses than that of Americans living here that were born here. And so when you look at those real numbers, not the made up numbers that the politicians use for speaking points, but when you look at the real numbers, immigrants do a lot to stimulate our economy. The other thing we want to look at is the immigrants that come to work the orange groves and the watermelon fields and all of the agricultural based fields and things that we generate in this country to feed our people, to sell to other countries, to generate the revenue that we desperately need. When you start deporting people who do these types of jobs that Americans really don't want to do, then it has an adverse effect on our economy, because if crops are not getting picked, if crops are not getting produced, then it causes inflation in the market. And when food starts to rise to the point where people aren't able to buy it as though they were before, then people start to, you know, they start to feel it because, you know, they can't afford it. And when they can't afford it, then, you know, people stop spending and the economy starts to drop in value. And that's one of the things that was taking place, because a lot of the workers that were working the fields, they were scared to go to work because they didn't want to get deported. And so in situations like that, I feel that we have to, you know, streamline the process and make sure that people who are bringing skilled labor over here, people that are bringing hard work ethic, people that want to help build this country, I think we should give them an opportunity, especially with the idea that this country was built on immigration. We are a nation of immigrants. So it's kind of like I come to your home and I stay for a while, and now that I'm there, I kick you out. And then when things get too bad for you, you come back, and then you tell me that I can't come back because I have to go through some legal paperwork. Well, a lot of the Mexicans that are coming to this country, I say this all the time, today's Mexicans are yesterday's Native Americans that were forced off their land during the Trail of Tears, were forced, you know, from California during the Gold Rush, were forced into Mexico whenever we were dealing with the railroad expansion. These people were trying to escape slavery. They were trying to escape getting shot and killed, and ended up in present-day Mexico. And so now that these individuals are trying to come back home, they're being faced with a great deal of resistance. And so I just think it's kind of bogus that Republicans are using this false narrative that the only people that are coming to this country are rapists, murderers, and thieves. I mean, I just don't buy that. You know, I know too many migrant individuals, especially growing up in Hardy County, where these people pretty much stay to themselves. They work all day. I've been in the orange groves working with these individuals. This is back-breaking labor. At the end of the day, the only thing you want to do is to find somewhere to lay down. And so, you know, maybe some of these politicians ought to get out here and do some of this work. and maybe they'll have a better understanding of what this is really all about.
Well, Alan Ellison, you've answered my questions. There was just one more issue I wanted to bring up, and that was your somewhat unconventional path towards the Democratic Party nomination in this congressional race, which, of course, we know came after the rather shocking and tragic death of April Freeman. Can you give us just some insight into how you were selected to pick up that mantle and continue running this campaign, and why you decided to accept this challenge?
Sure. Well, it all started back in 2016 when I was a candidate for this race in this district. I campaigned for 15 months, and at the 15th month is when I had to qualify in Tallahassee. So I had just driven 7 hours to get to Tallahassee to pay my ballot fee, and I wrote my check out for $10,400. Only to realize minutes after the closing period that the amount was supposed to be for $10,440. And so that mishap on my part caused me to not make the ballot. And so after 15 months of campaigning, I pretty much had saturated the district. I had spoken in all of the clubs, all of the BECs, all of the churches. So I had a huge following. And so whenever, 2018 rolled around, I had pretty much still had a solid base. So when April unexpectedly passed away, I was asked if I would put my name in the hat. And so I accepted. And when I did, I got voted for overwhelmingly 51% of the vote against three other candidates. And so I'm here today, just days into the race, and I only have about 27, 28 more days left. And so it's been tough trying to pull this together in such a short time frame. So, I'm out here, doing the interviews. I'm trying to raise the monies necessary to mount up a serious campaign in a very short time frame. I am the people's voice. I'm from the district. I'm the native son of the district, and people, They listen to me. I listen to them. We work together in a very collaborative way. And that's why I'm running, and that's why I'm going to be the voice of the people in Congress.
Well, Alan Ellison, Democratic candidate to represent Florida's 17th congressional district, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
That was a previously recorded conversation with Alan Ellison. He's the Democratic candidate vying to represent Florida's 17th congressional district in next month's general election. That district covers all or portions of 9 counties, including Lee, Sarasota, Charlotte, Okeechobee, Glades, Hardy, Polk, Highlands, and DeSoto. Ellison faces Republican Greg Stube in that race, and our invitation for Greg Stube to appear on the show remains open. That's all the time we have for today's program. Stay tuned to Gulf Coast Live throughout the next several weeks for more conversations with Republican and Democratic candidates vying to represent Southwest Florida districts in Congress, as well as those seeking state cabinet positions. Tomorrow at 1, the Democratic candidate running for Florida's 19th congressional district, David Holden, joins us live in studio. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary, Julie Glenn, and myself. Our director is Richard Cinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.